awful pain. Now I understand what you are prepared to go through when your life depends on it. During the day I go through hell with my feet, and at night the yells of the oncoming Soviets rip me out of my death-like sleep. I recall that for weeks afterwards, on quiet days, I would wake up from nightmares in which a deep voice of a yelling Russian had been following me around. He was forever on our heels, shouting, "Hurrah!" and never giving us any respite. How I would have loved to have given this noisy devil a burst. But only having my pistol, Otto's submachine gun, was out of ammunition. It would have been suicide. So, in my terror, I preferred to run for my life on raw flesh. Many soldiers did not manage to get away and were shot out of hand or bayoneted. Others were driven crazy and went for the attacking Soviets with their bare hands or fell on their knees and begged for mercy. The Soviet soldiers just laughed as they massacred them. I didn't notice any prisoners being taken. It was days before the yelling behind us stopped, but instead we can now see the Soviet soldiers marching forward on both sides of us, almost near enough to touch. They do not even bother to get into position to fire on us. We are a sorry sight, tired and bedraggled. They do take the liberty of taunting us with a victory pose as they pass by on their little wagons, loaded with all kinds of things. This seems to me to be downright grotesque, to see the enemy so near at hand just marching by instead of fighting with him, and to be shown only threatening fists and ridicule. Occasionally, their advance units run into strong German opposition. Then they withdraw and leave behind masses of murdered Russian women and children in the villages, hacked to death along the muddy roads and in the houses. Above all, there remains an unremitting hatred towards the Germans and towards all those who have served them during the occupation. They don't ask if those who have served have done so voluntarily or if they have been forced to do it. It's enough that they have lived under German occupation. The Russian army demands obedience without equivocation to the patriotic slogan, "Rather dead than enslaved." The same words always come from those on the winning side, the motive always being hatred for all who think differently. If everyone temporarily forced to do something against his will or his convictions had to be struck down, very soon there would be nobody left. These women, murdered by their own forces, were really only normal, everyday women. God knows they didn't want to work for their occupiers. They only wanted to survive. These terrible pictures send an additional shiver into my body, driving me forward ever more determinedly. I have the feeling that I am wading through blood in my boots. When we arrive at a village in which a group of stout-hearted soldiers has just driven the Russians out, I suffer terrible pains which I simply cannot stand. My feet are burning, as if I've been running over hot coals. For the first time, I shout with pain. "I am finished, Otto. Nobody can run on raw flesh all the way to the Bug." "You have to," Otto insists, and tries to calm me. We are about 100 meters behind the last of the trailing party. Nobody pays any attention to us. And why should they? Everyone's had enough. And what difference would it make anyway if one person stays behind and dies? But I don't want to peg out, not yet. I grit my teeth and drag myself forward once again. The fire in hell can't be worse than this, I think, and at the same time I bite my lip until it oozes blood for having let my willpower slip. But after a short period, the pain is so unbelievable that I resign myself to my fate. I am completely finished, and my willpower is paralyzed. I can go on no further. I can't take another step. With a groan, I let myself fall into the mud. Otto wants to get me going. He even tries the Russian yell and calls me a lazy dog and so on. I don't react. My spirit is broken. The pain almost finishes me at every step. "It's over, Otto. I can't take any more. I'm going to stay here, come what may. I just don't give a damn," I moan. "When the Russians come, I've got my pistol. But you hurry on, Otto, so you can catch up with the rest." Otto is livid. "Don't talk such nonsense. At least let's go to the next hut. When you have rested for a bit, we might be able to go a little further." He takes me under the arm and helps me up. A hot current runs through my body, reaching up into my throat. Is this the end? Damn! I've been on the front lines for months, and have at most been slightly wounded in the many close combats. And now my life is hanging in the balance all because of a couple of lousy army boots which are tearing the skin off my bones. Well, I guess it has to be that way. I could, of course, have pulled off the boots long ago and run barefoot, as so many others are doing. However, when I see what has happened to so many of the men who have done just that, and what infections and other problems they have picked up from the mud, I decide that I would rather keep the boots on. In any case, I would probably never have been able to get the boots back on again due to the swellings. With Otto's help, I manage to drag myself to the next cabin. It's empty, but we come across a small chunk of bread and a glass jar containing some beets. The food gives us some new energy, but it also makes me dead tired. And while Otto snoops around the cabin and outside, I lie down on an iron bedstead with the army blanket wrapped around me, and immediately fall asleep. Eventually, I can hear my name being called, as if from far away, so I get up and drag myself to the door. Otto is waving to me from the other side of the street, beckoning me to join him. Beside him are two scruffy-looking Russian ponies, two hemp ropes rather than the normal bridles around their necks. He has a broad grin on his face.
"Took me a good half hour to round up these little beasts, but they're our only chance of getting out of here in a hurry."
With that, he presses one rope into my hand and is already on the back of his pony, without even asking me if I can ride. My pony is not a big animal, and with a single bound I am on his back and pressing my legs around his belly. He immediately stands up on his front legs, raises his hindquarters, and starts shaking like a wet cat. I slide forward and am almost thrown off, but at the last moment manage to hold on to his bushy mane.
"Davai! Davai!" yells Otto as he slams his heels into his animal's flanks.
The pony trots along and is soon several meters in front of me. Then my one scurries after Otto's, jolting my bones, and only by clinging on to the mane can I manage to stop it unseating me. This riding is good fun, I decide, but only if you know how. I have only ridden once, and that was on a fat old farm horse. It was in the first year of the war, when we were ordered by the school to help bring in the harvest. I remember that riding on that thing was much easier than riding on this spindly creature. Otto's pony goes too slowly for his liking, so he smacks the nag on the neck and digs his heels into its flanks, but the little horse doesn't move any faster. In return, it tries to snap at his legs. My pony copies what his is doing, just as if they had agreed upon it. He too bends his head back towards me and snaps at my knees. I move backwards and just about manage to cling on to his mane. One foot is already dragging on the ground.
"This devil will be the end of me yet," I moan, and because of his jerking gait, I am rattled from side to side, and it sounds as if I am stuttering.
I slide from left to right and back again, and feel like a bundle of clothes on an old wheelbarrow. I can feel every jolt the blessed thing makes as my backside lands against the animal's bony spine.
"No, Otto, I'd rather get off and walk, even on these bad feet," I call to him in a stuttering voice.
Otto, who is in front of me, turns around, then ducks suddenly flat along the neck of his nag.
"The Russians!" he calls,
and then rifle salvos rattle off from between the houses, and the bullets zip around our ears. My nag makes a leap and stretches his legs in a gallop, with me pressing my chest against his neck and clinging to his mane. We easily overtake Otto, who is also now galloping. Suddenly, I find riding to my liking. I feel as if I am in a cradle, and notice with pleasure that we are very quickly putting some distance between ourselves and the enemy fire. Both animals have passed the last of the houses and are now galloping out on the open steppe. Then mine, out in front, stops suddenly and snorts so heavily that the foam flies into my face. As I turn around, Otto comes sweeping by. The mane of the little beast waves in the wind, and Otto, in his fur cap, looks like a Cossack on the attack. He stops beside me. Even though it is light, we can't see the village behind us. My pony moves off at a canter, and I again start bouncing around like a bundle of rags. Later we come across another village, and he stops and decides not to take another step. Otto's follows its lead,
and they both look at us scornfully. "We have to get down," says Otto. "They're in one of their moods. I've seen this before. Panier ponies are unpredictable." "Good. We'll walk until they get over it and let them stretch their legs," I say, glad to be able to dismount. Every bone in my body is aching, it seems, and my rear end has pretty well had it. Nevertheless, thanks to the food and sleep, my feet have had a chance to recover a bit, and I'm not now in so much pain when I walk. As we approach the village, Otto can see through his field glasses that there are lots of Russians there, so we are forced to skirt round the village using a rachel. By the time we are almost past it, shots are again being fired, from behind and also from the side. We are up on the backs of the animals again like lightning. Unfortunately, they are already upset and want to get away. They are off at a gallop, as if the devil himself was after them. We don't mind. They relax into a trot only when we reach the broad, well-used mud road of the retreating troops. We continue westward through the mud and the hard-packed steppe. There are frequent downpours, and the ice-cold wind causes our bodies to stiffen. We give the ponies food and water on the way, but instead of being grateful, they continue to be temperamental. Every now and then they stop and stand still, and nothing we say will cajole them into moving. Even when we try to trick them with a few rounds from Otto's submachine gun, the little devils show no reaction. They know full well who it is that's doing the shooting. Us, not the enemy. When we go to pat them kindly on their heads, they snap and even try to bite us. They don't react to friendship, the aggressive little buggers. We reckon they must have been very harshly treated in the past. And every time my pony stares at me with his pale yellow eyes after he has been having a go at me, I always get the feeling that the little devil is laughing. Not until we have organized some old blankets and placed these over their sharp bones do they become a little easier to get along with, allowing us to ride for a bit longer. But again, only until they decide to stop and go through the old routine about not wanting to move. We're completely dependent upon the mood of these small, shaggy beasts. But even so, we're thankful that they have carried us for days on their backs, although I will frequently think about my seriously taxed rear end. Somewhere, far beyond the Inghul and near the Yelanyets, our riding days are over. One day, as we are looking around in some houses for quarters, having tied up the ponies at a tree, they suddenly vanish. As the ropes had not been torn away by force, we know full well that they've been stolen, along with their blankets, by other soldiers. It is the middle of March and the height of the muddy season. From now on, we join the retreating masses once more. Resistance is only offered if the enemy comes too close. Superiors are always trying to form combat units out of the demoralized men, but these dissipate after short periods of resistance. One day we find ourselves at a supply depot. We fill our pockets with chocolate, cigarettes, and other items. Just as we are about to down a thick slice of beer sausage, several mortar rounds crash nearby, and a soldier on the outside yells, "The Soviets are coming!" Electrified, everyone jumps up and runs to the exit. An Unteroffizier from one of the vehicles has already rolled out several diesel and petrol drums and then set fire to them. The jets of flame just miss his back. The Soviets are at the other end of the depot, and we soldiers run and pile onto the vehicles to get away faster. The crews curse and try to push some of the men away, but they cling to the vehicles like blackfly and fight each other for any free space. We manage just to hang on to a bit of the side cover, mainly to help us get through the mud a bit faster. A soldier calls out, "No more space, comrade. Let go, otherwise we'll have to get down." The damn fellow then stamps on our fingers with the heel of his boot until they bleed. We just have to let go, and we fall into the mud. There are many more like us. Otto is angry. "They aren't human anymore. They're just animals, and don't give a toss if other people die, just as long as they can save themselves. And they have the cheek to call us comrade. No space anymore, comrade. I'm sorry, comrade. They're the ones who are getting away, damn it. I'd like to punch them on the nose. What the hell do they know about comrades and the friendships which exist on the front lines? They spit the word out so easily without understanding what it really means." Otto has worked up a real fury, but afterwards he feels a bit better. He has also said exactly what I am thinking.
We clean off the worst of the mud and then run along in the trail left by the half-track. The Soviets are to the side, behind us, and are shooting at individual soldiers who try to take refuge among the houses.
"Here comes another half-track," Otto yells. "We've got to get up on this one, otherwise we've had it."
This vehicle is also full to bursting with soldiers. We run along beside it and wave to the driver. Then a Stabswachtmeister sticks his head out and gives the driver a signal. The half-track is now driving at a walking pace. We notice that the man's epaulette piping is the same gold-yellow as ours. He has also noticed that on us, and he stretches out his hands to Otto and me and asks,
"Which Schwadron?"
"First of the 21st,
we answer in union.
"Come on, I'm from the 8th of the 21st,
he replies, and shoves one soldier from the running board to the front mudguard and pulls another into the driver's cab. We both jump up onto the running board and hold onto the door. That's what you call being saved at the last moment. We are thankful that the Soviets behind us haven't got any heavy weapons, otherwise we would not have got away so easily. We managed to escape with only a few slightly wounded, me among them. I caught a glancing hit below the knee, a ricochet. It's only a graze, though, as were the others earlier. It doesn't cause any problems. At the next stop, I need only stick a plaster on it. Although we lose sight of the other vehicles for several hours, we drive over the bridge on the river Yelanets. There we run into another combat unit, which has a number of men from our own unit. A capable officer has tried to hold up the advancing enemy by counter-attacking and has even managed to push him back for a short while. In one of the recaptured villages, I get hold of a German submachine gun from a Soviet officer, and with it several magazines of ammunition. He also has two German wristwatches on his arm. In the village, we can see the atrocities that have been committed by the Soviet soldiers against their own people. This bloody war, involving women and children. I think of Katya in Dnipravka and her prayer that the war should be over soon. Vojna kaput. How often she and many others prayed for that. And now, if her own troops move into her village, it will be their death sentence too. The hatred for those who had lived under the Germans has become bestial. The thorn of revenge sits so deep in their flesh that they can't stop killing even their own people. And then they tell us in their propaganda leaflets that they will treat us, their enemies, very well if we surrender. In the next few days we'll be getting close to the River Bug. This is supposed to be our interim destination. We're told that the enemy will be brought to a standstill here by strong German forces. However, before we reach the Bug, we have to survive a couple of very dangerous days, with our units scattered in all directions because of the overwhelming strength of an attacking Soviet force. To add to the misery, the rain is teeming down by the bucketful, making the mud and slime deeper and deeper, and making walking virtually impossible. We hang on to the frame of the pannier wagons, whose wet tarpaulins are blown about like the sails of a ship by the freezing easterly wind and smack us round our ears. It is a pitiful picture. The little pannier wagons, along with the tenacious, hardy steppe horses, are in the end the only means of transport for the troops. Tired, beaten, and as hungry as wolves, we reach the German reception stations at the Bug. Our unit has already been transferred from Voznesensk to Kantakuzenka on the west side of the river, where there is another reception station. Here we discover that most of our unit has already been flown by Ju-52 to Chisinau in Romania. Otto and I remain in our quarters for 3 days, making ourselves more or less human again. Then, as it is assumed that the last of the stragglers from our unit have already reported in, we and some others are flown in an old Ju-52, without seats, directly to our unit in Chisinau. Although I have flown at the glider school at Sensburg in East Prussia, this is nevertheless my first flight in a motor-driven aircraft. Thinking back, I can say that this flight in the old Tante U was really enjoyable, not least because we were finally leaving Russia. Chapter 12. Deadly Intermezzo. The city of Chisinau looks like a jewel box in comparison with the dirt and mud of Russia. It even has a Western character. It's the 27th of March, and the Russians are said to have already crossed the River Prut and advanced into Moldavia. The city has been cleared of all communications units, so now we only meet up with German and Romanian frontline units in the streets. The spring sun is just beginning to test its strength, allowing us to make the most of several days. We receive almost daily delicious golden yellow Romanian wine in a bowl. After the arduous weeks during the retreat, new vigour is again flowing, giving us renewed hope after the retreat. But it doesn't last long. The enemy, who is also having problems with the deep mud, has brought his tanks and heavy weapons forward and pushed back the Romanian front between Iasi and Roman a considerable distance and occupied the important railway and road links between Chișinău and Iasi. We were ordered to retake these areas, and we managed to do this with the support of the Großdeutschland Panzergrenadier Regiment. This unit was not the Waffen-SS outfit of the same name, but a well-equipped combat unit alongside which we had frequently fought in the past. During this period I've been wounded in the leg again, but I have been able to rest a few days with the trains. Valdi and Gustav Koller have also been having problems. As a result of the earlier wound in his leg, Gustav frequently had difficulty running and so was often left with the supply trains. From the time we got to Romania, he and Varias were assigned to our HMG section. In the meantime, our trains were diverted to Iasi, a city of about 100,000 people. 1st of April. Our unit is again being used to drive back an enemy unit which has broken into the Romanian positions. They are fighting near Holești. I'm still with the rear trains, and I'm delighted to be able to remain in quarters at the moment. The weather has turned completely. After starting to rain in the morning, it has changed around and developed into a severe snowstorm, as bad as the one I experienced once in 1942 in Russia. Within a very short space of time, everything is snowed in and the roads are impassable. Even our weapons are so iced up that every counterattack is being delayed. 6th of April. This snowstorm has lasted for 3 days, and only today can our men return to their quarters. They had survived some really harsh conditions. 7th to the 14th of April. The enemy is now only 4 kilometers from Iasi. He has again overrun the Romanian positions with tanks and infantry, and is now marching on the city. While our unit takes care of the security of the northern flank, the 26th Regiment and a few tank battalions are attacking the enemy. We are committed a bit later, and are immediately attacked by a swarm of Russian aircraft, which bomb us. Over the following days, we are continuously involved in hard fighting and cut the tips off the advancing enemy troops, thus detaching them completely from their main attacking body. As a result, the enemy comes to a standstill. We have lost out on an Easter holiday. On these 2 days, we are storming trenches held by the strong Soviet units and forcing the enemy back towards the north. 15th of April. The Romanians are now able to return to their earlier positions, but we wonder how their officers can go into action like men on parade, all spruced up and with well-ironed uniforms. When I have the opportunity to talk to a Romanian soldier who comes from the Banat region and who speaks German well, I learn that their officers frequently leave the positions at night in order to drive into Iasi to amuse themselves with women. We see in this undisciplined attitude one reason why the Romanians, whenever a strong enemy attack takes place, leave their trenches and go AWOL. There must be an unbelievable relationship between officers and men in their army, something akin to serfdom, I expect. I've often seen officers whipping soldiers or kicking them. I have, by the way, seen similar behaviour among the Hungarians. Once, when we were in position next to the Romanians in front of Iasi, we could hear the orgies being indulged in by the officers behind us at night, even though we were in the front trenches. As a prank, but also because we were annoyed, we shot up some flares and tracers with our rifles and threw a couple of hand grenades to make things noisy, and we almost split our sides laughing as they dashed back half-drunk and half-dressed. 18th to the 22nd of April. Waldemar Krekel and Gustav Koller are being recommended for promotion to Unteroffizier, and I am helping them write up their personal statements to formulate their applications correctly. In the Schwadron, it is common knowledge that I've no ambition to become a Gruppenführer. I have never given the real reason, because I don't want to be misunderstood or be blamed for wanting to shirk responsibility. In truth, I have become as skilled as I can ever hope to be with my heavy machine gun, and I feel that the best way I can serve my unit is to be the main machine gunner. But I won't hide the fact that I would feel naked without my HMG. The battles are hard, and I put my survival down to God's help and the fact that I am armed with a strong weapon upon which I can always depend. I'm also proud that, together with Fritz Hamann, I am the last first gunner in the Schwadron to have survived since September 1943 without any major injury, and as a result have contributed to the successes we have achieved on numerous occasions. The hardships suffered during the war have left their imprint on me. The continuous stress on the nerves requires longer and longer periods of recovery. These are secured less through regular periods of leave than through a wonderful Heimatschuss, but in any event they shouldn't cause any permanent scars. 25th of April. During our short rest period, the Schwadron is once again honoured with additional decorations. Besides several Iron Crosses first class, two Iron Crosses second class were awarded, one to a Feldwebel from the rifle platoons and one to me. As a result of having participated in the continuous close combat fighting from the bridgehead in Nikopol until the present time, we, the survivors of our squadron, are now awarded the Silver Close Combat Badge. However, I do not think that these decorations make much difference to my morale. I have a sort of spiritual dread, like that I had at Rychow when the death run began. The current situation is, however, different. I therefore think that my uneasiness has been brought about by the many exciting close combat firefights I've gone through, which sort of left me unscathed, but now demand a price from my body. As I began to think about this some days later, it occurs to me that this condition is like seeing a kind of curtain before going through a bad experience which is to come, although as soon as it is over I feel normal again. In retrospect, it occurs to me that this inner turmoil always comes along before I get wounded, even though this might involve only a minor injury. 28th of April. Since our Oberleutnant is commanding the Schwadron, even we old ones, who have grown tired of the many engagements, have sensed something like a rebirth of the will to fight. Because of his calm way and sure manner, particularly during these hard weeks in Romania, he gives us the strength and the momentum always to carry our close combats to a successful conclusion. He is always leading from the front during the attacks, and I know that we are, all of us, prepared to go through hell for him. But he is too reckless at times. For example, I have never seen him with a helmet on his head, even during heavy artillery or mortar fire. He always wears his lightweight officer's cap over his dark, somewhat wiry hair, giving him a youthful, dashing appearance. Even though he has suffered several injuries, he believes, as all of us do, that he will survive. And since he's come through many a hot situation unscathed, he's become a symbol of invulnerability. It therefore hits us all that much harder when, during an attack, his exemplary, irreplaceable life is brutally snuffed out when his head is split open by a shell. So as not to anticipate my notes on his death, I would like to follow the right sequence of events and begin with how we, on a beautiful spring day, are in position outside a Romanian village and letting the sun really warm us through. Although we can't detect any enemy movement in the village, we know that the Russians have occupied it. Everything appears quiet, almost serene. The spring sunshine is playing on the fresh green grass all around us. The heat makes us tired and lazy, and even I doze off a bit at the edge of my foxhole. I look over at my chief, who is sitting on the ground in a hollow nearby. He is whittling a new shape in his knotted stick. All the soldiers are enjoying the sun, and the peace and quiet an interlude between the bloody combats of this brutal war provides. No shells are screaming through the clear air which separates the two front lines. Only once in a while does a drunken cacophony or the high-pitched yell of a Romanian woman show that Ivan is busy in the village. Just a few days ago, I pitched a completely drunken Ivan out of the bed of a shrieking Romanian woman in a village we had just occupied. He was so legless that he did not even realize that he was fighting a war and that we were his enemies. As he was not even in a condition to be taken away with the other prisoners, we decided to pull all of his clothes off and throw them down a well. Then we tossed him amongst some cackling chickens on a dung heap. Unfortunately, we couldn't hang around for him to wake up. We just hoped that the Romanian women would not let him escape his just deserts. We were just at discussing this incident of a few days ago with Varias and Fritz Hamann, and imagining Ivan waking up, when we heard the chief calling out in a surprised voice, "What's the matter with those Ivans over there?" He then runs over to me in the foxhole and looks through his field glasses towards the village. "They must be struck with the tropical frenzy, those creeps," he mumbles to himself and begins to laugh. As I look through the field glasses, I break out in laughter too. "Must be drunk, Herr Oberleutnant. They're dancing around like lunatics," I remark, amused. In the meantime, the entire unit is doubled up with laughter, the soldiers arguing about why the Russians are dancing like crazy in front of the village, going through all sorts of madcap routines. I imagine that Red Indian war dances must have looked a bit like this, having read about them in the cowboy novels of Alaska Jim. Then some of the soldiers in the foxholes in front of the village also get up and intermingle with the other dancers, at the same time waving their arms about. We can hear their yells all the way over to our lines. What is happening? Are they so drunk that they have fallen into a sort of trance? We are speculating on what the matter is. Varias, standing in the next foxhole, calls over to us. "Wow, they must have sunstroke. They're actually running over here." Right. We can see it now. A bunch of Russians are running directly towards us, as if they are chased by the very devil. As they're running, they're flapping their arms all about, as if trying to fly. What is this? A new tactic by the Russians? I'm already behind my machine gun, and keeping a careful watch on the oncoming enemy, just in case. I reckon there are about 20 of them rushing towards us. Soon they'll have reached the rifle platoons on our right flank. The Oberleutnant, who has been keeping them under observation through his field glasses, lays his hand gently on my shoulder. "Don't shoot. They're unarmed." I immediately take my finger off the trigger and watch the Russians, one after the other, leap over our foxholes and keep on running. Our men crouch right down and let them tear on past. "What the devil's going on?" I hear our chief calling. Then someone replies, "Bees! A great swarm of mad bees!" Some of our men get up out of their foxholes and run after the Russians. So, a swarm of bees is the answer to the riddle. They caused such panic that the Russians even threw away their weapons and rushed over towards the enemy. To us, it was an interesting spectacle, full of comic entertainment, although we're thankful the Russians didn't run across our foxhole. God knows, it's no fun being attacked by a swarm of bees. The Russian soldiers who ran over to our lines, and many of our own, have been badly stung, but then someone comes up with the idea of setting fire to bundles of straw from a stack and dispersing the bees with smoke. We took 19 Russians prisoner in this manner. However, first, they had to be treated. Two of our soldiers had heads which looked more like balloons, which rendered them hors de combat for a short time. 29th of April. In the grey of the morning, our tanks are moving forward gingerly. They are so silent that we only realise they're there when they're almost upon us. As our artillery opens fire, we follow immediately behind and take the enemy so completely by surprise that he leaves everything where it is and flees the village. We even surprise some of the Russians in their sleep. The confiscated pannier wagons are brim full with food and wine casks. The successful Soviet army are living like kings. Their motto is eat, drink, and with animal lust, rape the Romanian women. Following us come the Romanian troops, and they reoccupy the village. Our fighting has just begun for this day. After a short break, we drive on in a northwesterly direction towards the city of Horlesht. With support from Romanian artillery, as well as from our own assault guns, we force the enemy back in spite of his determined defence. Above us, vigorous dogfights are developing between our pilots and the Russians. When, after some time, we reach a new Soviet trench system, we are met with murderous artillery and mortar fire. The enemy doesn't intend to pull back any further, and our forward momentum is stopped. We crouch in the protective holes which Ivan has left behind all over the place.
"Bring the gun into position and hang on," says the chief, watching through his field glasses the forest to our left in front of us, from which we are getting heavy machine gun fire.
With Varias's help, for the time being he is my assistant gunner, we set the machine gun up as close to the ground as possible and aim it at the point where the fire is coming from. The Soviets are sitting firmly in their positions in front of us, and apparently also have mortars with them in the forest. They are hammering us with them so hard that the splinters are zinging around our heads, and we have to crouch down after each burst. Varias, beside me, complains, "Damn, now we could really use our pots, and like idiots we had to forget them and leave them back on the trucks."
He's right. I, too, have just been thinking about our helmets back on the truck, which we've exchanged for our peaked caps. Whoever would have thought that the Soviets would employ this many heavy weapons? But we had actually become quite lax as regards our helmets during the last few weeks. As soon as we put them on, we changed our minds, saying that the heat had made wearing them too unpleasant. The real reason was, however, our indifference, and the belief that nothing could happen to us old-timers. And, until now, everything had gone well. Besides, the chief never wears a steel helmet, even though his runner, Obergefreiter Kluger, always had it on his belt.
As the splinters fizz around us at an ever-increasing rate, Kluger takes the helmet off his belt and hands it to the chief. The latter looks at it for a moment, then across to us.
"Does one of you want to put it on?" he asks.
Varias and I look at each other and shake our heads.
"Well, okay."
He shrugs his shoulders and looks through the field glasses in order to observe the enemy again. To him, the matter is settled, but his runner is still standing by, looking uncertain. We know that Kluger would have preferred to have slapped the helmet on his chief's head out of sheer concern. He idolizes him and is more worried about his safety than he is about his own. But he can't force the matter, and he fastens the helmet back on his belt. Kluger and most of my friends are smarter and donned their helmets at the start of this attack. Quite routinely, I fire off one belt after another into the enemy position. Then I discover two Russian machine gun positions at the edge of the forest, which have already caused several injuries amongst the soldiers of the rifle platoons on our right flank. With a loud explosion, a mortar round lands just in front of us. The iron splinters whirl around and dig into the ground. One hits the steel jacket of the machine gun, and the Oberleutnant quickly withdraws his hand. Blood starts to flow over his fingers from a wound at the base of the hand. Obergefreiter Kluger, who's seen what's happened from the other foxhole, is frightened and yells towards the rear,
"Medic! The Oberleutnant has been wounded!"
The chief has already taken out his handkerchief and is pressing it against the wound. More surprised than angry, he calls over to his runner,
"Are you crazy, Kluger? Fancy calling the medic here on my account."
Kluger yells again,
"We don't need a medic, it's only a gash in the hand."
Then he waits until the chief is back in his foxhole, where he attends to the injury with gauze and some first aid plaster. I settle again behind my machine gun and fire away at every Russian head I can see. Then another mortar round explodes in front of us, and I feel a pain on my upper lip. A small splinter has penetrated beneath my nose. The blood flows over the lip into my mouth. I spit it out and press my handkerchief against it. My upper lip and nose swells up.
"Let the medic bandage you and go to the rear. Varias can take over the machine gun," the chief says, concerned.
I shake my head. "It looks worse than it is, chief. It's only a little splinter sticking in just under my nose." He looks at me briefly, then returns to watch through his field glasses. I have the feeling that he expected nothing less of me. I am to him a dependable type, not to be upset by a slight injury. He'll probably be disappointed if I go to the rear now, although for this type of injury I would have every right to do so. I'm also honest enough to admit that if I'd had another chief at this time, I would have gone to the rear to get myself bandaged by the medic, and thus get out of the firefight that is taking place. My nerves are probably not strong enough after this long period of frontline duty to withstand this combat while suffering from a painful injury. I am not a coward, as I have already proved, but neither have I ever tried to play the role of the hero. But now it looks as if I am trying to be one, because my comrades, who can see my swollen face, are wondering why I am not already at the rear. It's the Oberleutnant who gives me strength, so I don't go back, but rather choose to remain with him. I feel tied to him, and would go through hell with him. After you have spent some time at the front, like I have, you no longer fight for Führer, Volk und Vaterland. These ideals have long gone, and no one talks about National Socialism or similar political matters. From all our conversations, it's quite obvious that the primary reason we fight is to stay alive and help our frontline comrades to do the same. But we often also fight for a superior, such as our Oberleutnant, who through his exemplary attitude manages to instill spirit into even dog-tired and almost indifferent warriors. What does he fight for? As an officer, first of all, because of duty and honour. However, I know him, and the main reason is his responsibility towards his soldiers, and, through personal leadership and example at the front, to take away some of the feelings that they are mere cannon fodder. When he speaks of his unit, he means the unity and the camaraderie of the Schwadron. For me and others, this is something still worth fighting for, particularly in the absence of any other ideals. In all the months he has been with us, I have never heard him mention politics, nor heard him speak about National Socialism. I have the feeling that he stands way above these things, and that he is not carrying on this war with any political agenda. The Schwadron cannot move another pace forward because of the heavy enemy counterfire, and the Leutnant makes a decision. Watching the edge of the forest to our left, he says, "We've got to get into that forest. Then we can roll up his positions from the flank." That could be very difficult indeed, we reckon, because there are lots of Soviet soldiers in the forest. Obergefreiter Klüger expresses our feelings. "Shouldn't our artillery give them a pasting first, Herr Oberleutnant?" "What on earth for? We'll manage without it, Klüger. Tell the troops from the Schwadronstrupp and the 1st Platoon to follow up as soon as I've gone." He then turns to Fritz Hamann and me. "You give us covering fire with both machine guns until we reach the forest. Then come after us and wait for further orders." "We understand, Herr Oberleutnant." Minutes later he runs in front of his men along a shallow depression hidden by undergrowth towards the edge of the forest. We give continuous cover from both machine guns. As the Soviets see our men coming towards them, they jump up and run in groups towards the rear into the undergrowth. The chief reaches the forest, the others follow him, and they all disappear into the trees. "Go! After them!" I grab the mounting by the two rear legs while Varias gets hold of the front two. We run at the double towards the edge of the forest, and a few meters to the side come Fritz, Hamann and Klemm, the latter recently returned from leave. Spluttering, we reach the edge of the forest and take a quick breather. Then incoming mortar fire rushes towards us and explodes in the treetops. Ivan is pouring crossfire into the forest. Heavy grenades explode in the treetops, and broken branches crash down on us, hitting the tree trunks and undergrowth. We hear the Oberleutnant's orders reverberating through the forest, and hear the firing of the light machine gun and submachine gun. In the roaring and exploding hell, we take cover behind a tree trunk that has been felled in a storm, and await further orders. A figure emerges from the cloud of black powder in front of us. "Heavy machine gun section," someone calls. "Here, what's up?" I reply. "The Oberleutnant wants the 2nd HMG to move about 100 meters to the right edge of the forest to secure our flank. The 1st MG is to follow me." Fritz Hamann is already up and running with Klemm through the undergrowth to the right flank. We stumble over roots and fallen branches and rush after the runner. Above us, the mortar rounds are howling and exploding in the trees. Varias coughs and curses. I can hear his voice, but in the hellish din I can't understand a word he is saying. He's probably thinking, as I am, that we'd be prepared to give it everything if only we had our helmets on, but we haven't got them. The only thing I can do is tuck my head down between my shoulders and pray that no splinter will hit me, although at the moment they are raining down all around us. I can feel goose pimples over my head, and I can literally feel my hair standing up. At last we catch up with the men of the rifle platoons. They already have a few slightly wounded, A medic is currently attending to them or sending them to the rear.
Where is the Oberleutnant? The runner asks an Unteroffizier.
Further up front.
We hurry between the trees towards the front. Suddenly our chief is standing beside us.
Hurry up, men, he says. You've got to get your machine gun into position on the edge of the forest. The Oberleutnant is there.
Then he disappears with some men in the same direction. We run over tree trunks and splintered branches to the edge of the forest. The legs of the mountain keep getting caught up in shrubs, and we stumble and fall. As we get close to the edge of the forest, we are met with a yell from Kluger, which hits us like a bullet.
Medic! The Oberleutnant has been badly wounded!
We run the few paces over to Kluger. Then we see the Oberleutnant. He is lying with eyes closed and an ashen face on the forest floor. Beside him are his ornately carved knotted stick and his submachine gun. His runner, Kluger, is crouched beside him and is applying a compressed bandage to a head wound caused by a mortar splinter from the treetops. Kluger is sobbing like a child, his tears drawing light furrows in his grubby face. Varias and I are deeply touched, and my throat is dry. Others join us, their expressions pained. We are all lying around on the ground, staring speechlessly at our Schwadronschef, whom we all thought invulnerable. I can only imagine each man's thoughts, because in spite of the fury and thunder all around us, we are at this moment quite numb. If the world had suddenly come to an end, none of us would have moved. Only when the Sanitätsunteroffizier has bandaged him do we loosen up. The anxious question which can be read in our faces is answered by the medic while he continues with his bandaging.
The Oberleutnant is still alive, he says, but the splinter has penetrated into his head. He must be taken back to the main medical station as quickly as possible and be seen by a doctor.
Then the medic points to the helmet, carried as usual on Kluger's web belt.
If he had worn that, the splinter may not have gone in.
We know that Kluger mustn't blame himself. He had done his duty many times by offering his superior his helmet. Our Oberwachtmeister, who was also affected by the chief's condition, reminds us that we were in the middle of an attack.
Okay, everybody up to the edge of the forest, in position, he calls out to us.
Only minutes have passed since this painful incident, and we can already hear the rattling of Fritz Hamann's heavy machine gun. We grab the HMG by the legs once more and run towards the edge of the forest. My throat is still tied up in knots and my knees are shaking. But we are at war, and no one's interested in how an individual soldier is feeling. I fire my weapon like an automaton, and with the others rake the enemy flank from the edge of the forest. Stukas appear in the sky a little later to bomb the enemy, and as a result we are able to push him back several kilometres. The example set by the Oberleutnant has been a major factor in our victory. But it has been a temporary, indeed meaningless victory, won and paid for with high losses. Apart from the serious injury to our chief, we have several dead and many wounded. After we reach the MBL at the north end of the edge of the forest and settle down a bit, we miss Valdi and Obergefreiter Krekel, who during the attack had held the link to the rifle platoons together with Gustav Koller. Gustav reports that Valdi has been wounded by a mortar splinter in his hand and thigh. He has been taken back to the rear with the rest of the wounded. He had just had time to call over to Gustav to send us his greetings and tell us that we'd soon be following him. It might sound macabre, but I didn't envy or begrudge Valdi his wounds in any way. He and a few of us had held out for a long time, and it would have been awful if Valdi had been fatally wounded.
30th of April. In recent weeks, we have often discussed when we might suffer a wound that would take us out of the combat zone. That it will happen is inevitable. But even so, each of us believes that it will pass without serious consequences. Valdi, Fritz Hamann, the tall chap Varias, the professor, Gustav Koller, Clem, who after his leave has somehow changed, and I. All of us are old-timers, still left from the heavy weapons platoon from October 1943. In the rifle platoons there are only a handful from that time, even though some of them did return after being wounded at the Nikopol bridgehead. With only 3 gashes, I have come away from it all relatively unscathed. But these small splinter wounds are still considered injuries and are written up, and now I, like Clem and Gustav Koller, can wear the silver wound badge. Because of the splinter in my upper lip, I was able to rest in the rear trains for 3 days until the swelling went down. The regimental surgeon didn't want to cut open my lip to remove it, and so it has stayed put under my nose to this day. Chapter 13. From Knight's Cross to Wooden Cross. May 10th. Following the hard battles of the last few days, we finally have time to worry about personal matters. The bad and unsettling news that our highly respected Schwadron's chef had died as a result of his serious head wound reached us a week ago. He apparently never came out of his coma. We are reminded about his exemplary qualities as our leader and also as a human being. Fritz Hamann and I knew that he hated the war, but nevertheless would fight as a model for us to emulate, and that he contributed more than most. He would shoot at the enemy when we were threatened or when we were launching a counterattack, but he was also glad when many of them surrendered and thus stayed alive. And many a prisoner must have been surprised to be offered a cigarette and a light from a German officer. Because of these humane thoughts and deeds, he placed himself above and beyond the growing avalanche of hatred that is now characterizing the war. However, none of these qualities enabled him to escape death. It took him just as mercilessly, and tore him away from the camaraderie of his squadron, which was never as strong as under his leadership. 11th of May. Today I have received leave papers for 3 weeks from the orderly room. Early tomorrow morning I am supposed to leave with 2 other soldiers from our Schwadron. Gustav Koller does not let the chance slip by to give me a good haircut. He even refuses payment. In return, I am to take with me a bunch of letters and mail them from Germany, because this way they can be delivered faster than if they are mailed from our field unit. Even though I realize that my home leave is due, the news still comes as a surprise. Now, when the chance to escape the dirt and the danger for a couple of weeks becomes a reality, I really ought to enjoy myself. But it is not that way at all. I've got mixed feelings. On the one hand, I am glad to be able to see my loved ones again and to be able to sleep in a real bed. But on the other hand, it makes me sad to have to leave my comrades behind. For too long we have gone through thick and thin, bonded together in success and in adversity. It's like leaving my family in danger. Will I find them all in good health when I return? Including the time spent travelling, I'll be away for over 3 weeks, and for us in the front lines, much can happen in that time. It's only after we have drunk considerable quantities of Romanian wine, which makes everyone a bit tipsy, that I am able to forget the sadness of tomorrow's farewell for a while. 12th of May. Our driver, Obergefreiter Jost, wakes me up at 4 o'clock. Half an hour later, the 3 of us who are going on leave are sitting in the wagon on the way to the railway station. I was only able to say my goodbyes to Fritz Hamann and Varias. All the others are still sleeping off their binge. When you go on leave, you have to allow plenty of time, so I am told. The trains don't run to the old timetable anymore, and you have to find out about the new one at the station master's office. But we do manage to get out of Romania without too much trouble. Most of the soldiers in the passenger coach are from the front lines, and like me, don't feel like talking, and rather tired, quickly fall asleep to the rhythm of the train. Only after we reach Vienna, and after some of them had got off, does it become more lively in the carriage. I notice from their uniforms that they are rear area soldiers, discussing their amorous affairs in Austria and Hungary. 13th of May. During the journey, I am checked by the so-called chain dogs at least 5 times in the train and at the railway stations. This is the name we give the unloved military police because as their symbol of authority, they wear a shining metallic shield on their chests, hanging from a chain around their necks. Once in a while, they lead someone away. They are specifically checking all leave and travel papers, as well as the remarks written into each soldier's identity book. They do this in order to see if anyone has written themselves up for an extra decoration or if they have added a false promotion. Military policemen are no doubt necessary within units to keep order. In my compartment they take away a Feldwebel, decorated with the Knight's Cross First Class and also the Silver Close Combat Badge, but who in spite of this doesn't have all the right documents. From what I can hear, he doesn't have all his papers with him, so it's possible he might be AWOL. In conversations with other soldiers, I find that morale among the troops is not of the best. There are apparently a number of deserters and dissenters. These are bad times. They are called traitors to the fatherland because they don't do what we all must do, even though we don't like it. Nobody can be himself during a war. We all belong to the people and the state. The latter at least sounds good, because it means that everything that's done is done in the name of the people, in other words, in our name. 14th of May. It takes exactly 2 days to reach my home village. The pleasure of again seeing my mother and my older sister, who is on a visit, is tempered by the news of the death of some friends. Our usually quiet and empty little village has developed into a hectic, overpopulated city. There are soldiers and a lot of mothers and children from Berlin and other major cities on the streets, trying to escape the bombing. But for how long can they do that? 15th of May. I feel that, bearing in mind all the mixed feelings, my leave will not pass as pleasantly as expected. On the front lines we have other things on our mind. Our thoughts are more to do with our survival and that of our friends and comrades. Even though we have long since got used to the danger, the anxiety always comes back and eats away at the nerves. It makes young faces look old. I have some signs of this too. Next month I will be 21, but I feel much older, not least because I have outlived many younger colleagues. Even with my 5 minor injuries, I have come away from the war relatively unscathed. During combat, my nerves are somewhat flaky, but I do at least have them under control. I have often noticed over the last few months that younger and older men have turned grey overnight. Their nerves fail, and in an hour-long barrage they break down. And all of this is supposed to be in vain? God forbid that it will ever come to that. 16th of May to the 2nd of June. I am trying hard to enjoy my leave and to let myself be distracted. My favourite occupation? Sleep. In the afternoon I get on my racing bike and tour the area, or go over to the lake and do some fishing. I often spend the evenings with friends in a restaurant or with a girlfriend I knew before I left for the front. But things are not the same as when there was no unrest about, not like now, when I detect anxiety and discontent among the population. They all have something on their minds, but they don't dare express their opinions. I often get to hear that they have arrested someone and hauled them off to a concentration camp. People say that this is a labor camp whose guards are SS men. They place dissidents and those who oppose the Third Reich in the concentration camps. But no one knows anything for sure, as no one has ever come out of them. 3rd of June. I haven't been able to get to sleep lately. Too many things are running through my mind, and I am always thinking about my friends. I have the feeling that I won't see all of them again. If they are only wounded, they will, one day, come back. Only the dead do not return. And in every new firefight, there are always some to whom fate gives no chance. The closer I come to the end of my leave, the more I am affected, proving how close I feel to my friends at the front. 4th of June. I've been in a rattling train for hours, en route to my unit. The farewell from my mother was very difficult. She had made my leave as comfortable as she could. The work in her store had been very demanding, so she couldn't do as much for me as she would have liked. My father has been called up for service in a Volkssturmeinheit, which had been formed for deployment in the border area. The train is filled to capacity with army personnel from all different branches. My compartment is so crowded that I have to sit on a duffel bag in the corridor. 5th of June. We travel through the whole night. Twice we have air raid warnings, the train stopping out on the open track, but we aren't disturbed very much, and most of the soldiers sleep on. They are lying all over the floor of the train, and many have even made themselves comfortable in the baggage nets. It is absolutely pitch dark in the compartments, as no lights are allowed. But once in a while, the beam of a flashlight cuts through the darkness, or someone flips a cigarette lighter, in order to warn others that he needs to take a leak and doesn't want to step on anybody's head.